session number 19777, reel 6.
Norman, reel 6. You were just saying who you're about to relieve.
We were there to relieve the Welsh Regiment. Our mortar platoon comprised mainly of national servicemen. There was two sergeants and there should be four. But I think we got up to four corporals. But they were poor material. The companies had been told to nominate a corporal for the mortars, each one of them. And they didn't keep their best. One corporal was very good. And the rest, I'm afraid they were just unteachable. I'd done my best to try and teach them map reading, or advanced map reading, radio procedure, and battle drill, but they were too thick to take it in. Quite good fellows. I think they'd have been all right in a battle in a rifle company, but mortars needed a little extra, and they hadn't got it. So, being the only one that had ever been in action, it fell on me to show the way. First thing I did, told the company commander, Bill Blakey, that was the platoon commander, let's get all the weapons zeroed. So we did this. Let's throw some grenades. We did that. Let's get the mortar drill up to date. Fine. And we were about to go when there appeared two Koreans. And I said, yes, who are you? And my name is Oh In Koo, sir. Oh In Koo? Yes, I am the sergeant's houseboy. I said, what do you do? He says, I do sergeant's washing and fetch food and clean shoes. And I said, okay. And I said, have you always done this? Yes. He said, my friend, Yun Hak Bin. Yun was the officer's houseboy. Oh was a peasant. And he had his wits about him. Yun was a student from Seoul University, and he was a very brainy fella, but he hadn't much clue about how to do practical things. But they were grand lads, and they all brought another lot along who were the cooks. These were attached to us as porters to carry ammunition up the hills and things, but they were a bit wiser than that. And we thought this is a good thing. So we kept them, and the rest we sent back who were porters to the B echelon behind the line to do work there. We didn't particularly want them. We went off to the line, and the first place we went to was a place called Yongdong. Yongdong was a place where they would send freshly arrived troops to break them in a bit. We were so far from the enemy that our mortars wouldn't reach them. We took over from an Australian regiment, and the mortar platoon was commanded by a sergeant. I don't know if there was an officer, but this rough and tough sergeant, he looked after everything and ruled them with his fists. And his nickname was Horse. And he was a horse, but he was a grand fella. We liked him. We used it as a range, really. And we would shoot at everything. Each day we'd have a bang at things. And it helped to train the NCOs a bit and the mortar crews. And they all got used to everything. The ammunition was unlimited. There was only one nasty thing. We had one casualty. It wasn't from the enemy. It was, we had a misfire. A bomb got stuck in the barrel and they mishandled it and it went off. The bomb didn't explode, it went landed on the company in front. But the safety devices on it prevented it from going off. But the barrel recoiled and took off one of the crew's legs complete. We put him in the ambulance and threw his leg in after him. That was a great shame. It was very cold there. It was winter was coming, and after about the second night, the Black Watch, who were on a feature called the Hook, they got attacked. There was a big attack by the Chinese, and we didn't take any part in it, but our Vickers machine guns did. They had to cover a valley to prevent the Chinese reinforcing, and they were firing all night on this bitter cold night, and I think they fired something like 50,000 rounds of six guns, and the pits got so full of empties they had to shovel them out with a shovel. The surprising thing was that the guns kept breaking down because of the coldness had made the metal on the machine gun locks so brittle that they kept snapping. We used up all the spares and had to send for more. That was about the only thing. The thing that surprised me there was that all the mortars was in a battery of six. And I thought, God, what's this? Six mortars? They'll be knocked out first time we fire a shot. And had it been the Germans, and maybe the Japanese, they certainly would. But this was a different war, and I had to learn a different way. I didn't even see any counterfire. In fact, all the time I was in Korea, nobody ever fired a shot at us mortars. However, after 4 weeks of that, they moved us out, and we went to a hotter part of the front line. And we relieved the Durhams, the Durham Light Infantry. Good regiment. This was a hotter part. It was called Naechon. N-A-E-C-H-O-N. My observation post, which I call an OP, was about 800 yards from the enemy. And I lived in what we call a hoochie, a dugout. I was on my own for a start, but then I got them to send up one of the NCOs we were trying to train, not the corporals, but one of the younger ones, some of the national service lads who had got a bit more brains, and we trained them into observers. It was a sergeant's job. We had lance corporals doing it. The hoochie, it was dug out, there was beams put across and several rows of sandbags, and inside was a bed made out of wire pickets, and across was machine gun bolts. I had a double sleeping bag, and I slept in that. I was never allowed to take my boots off or anything. You had to be ready to jump out. We weren't allowed to zip it up. It was very cold, and I used to pull a balaclava and a cap comforter right over my head. But I couldn't sleep for the cold anyhow. And not only that, there were rats. Everywhere you went, there was rats. And I think they were a bit more scary than the enemy to start with. They would run over your sleeping bag in the night. And sometimes they would get in. None ever got in mine, but you'd hear fellas saying, oh, so-and-so woke up screaming in the night because he got a rat in his bag. Not very pleasant. It was a bit exposed, this one. So I had a Sten gun, and I lashed it down on a jerry can and pointed it to the door. So all I had to do was reach out and pull the trigger if anyone came to my hoochie and stood in the doorway and I thought it was a Chinese, I ought to pull the trigger. Each day I would go to the OP, and on the way there was a communication trench which only led to the OP. The Chinese had it under observation, and if you just walked down it, they saw you. When you got there, they would let you know that they knew you was there. very often, most more often than not, they didn't. But probably two or three times a week, they would fire three or four shells, half a dozen. The most I had was 26. And it would come from a single gun, I think. And they would land all around. None of them hitting it. Fortunately, had they done, I wouldn't be telling you this tale now, because it was a very flimsy affair. Just one row of sandbags across the trench was something to look through. A sort of a slot. But the big problem was, people would like to come and visit the front from the rear, to say they'd been at the front line, which, fine, I would welcome them. And I'd be sat there from dawn till dusk, never saw any Chinaman. And along would come some officer from the rear areas, and I'd say, did you just come down the trench, sir? And, yes. Did you crawl? I could see by their knees they didn't. Oh, no, I didn't bother to do that. Ha ha. I said, well, get out quick, because the Chinese might let us know that we're occupied. You should have crawled. I said, go on, get out quick. And let them see that you've gone out. And maybe they won't shoot at me then, that who's got to stay here. And that, I remember that particular time was the time when they fired 26 shells at me. But none of them hit. No, they were all close. Every night, we would have a little confab in the CP, as we called it, command post. And there was a gunner OP on the top, and he says, oh, he says, you don't want to. I was telling him that I'd had a rough time that day, and he says, well, come up and share mine. So I went to his Royal Artillery OP, and it was super. It was lovely. It was all really dug in and well sandbagged on top. It was heated. And across the front, the slot where you look through, there was perspex to keep the wind out. And there was also a beautifully drawn panorama of the area, which showed all the ranges and all the points and all the defensive fire spots and chairs to sit on. And we even had a periscope, so we didn't have to look at, expose ourselves. But it just happened this day that Chinky decided that he'd give us a go-over. He'd knock out the OP. And I no sooner got there when it started coming over. Again, I think it was a single gun, but it was a heavy one. Probably about 150 mm. And these shells kept landing. And this gunner was saying, let's see if we can see him. Yes, sir. And we'd have a look. Where do you think that's come from? Oh, I think it's come from there, sir. And then one would hit and they would get covered in muck. Didn't hurt us or anything. It wasn't very nice. And after about an hour, I think they fired some 30-odd shells. We'd been hit two or three times. No effect. He said, I think they're finished now. We got counter-bombardment on them. He said, oh, I think we're finished now. Would you like a cup of tea? And I says, I think I would, sir. So he got on the phone, and his henchman at the back, within a minute or two, came hurtling up with a kettle full of tea, and we sat there, and he says, you were very cool through that, Sergeant. Well, I said, if you don't mind me saying so, you was. He said, well, I was only cool because you was. And I said, no, I was only cool because you was. And he said, well, we're a pair of bloody fools. He said, next time they send anything over like that, we'll be out the back as quick as we can till it's over. So we agreed on that. But it never happened again, fortunately. I don't know how long we were in Nechon. I've not checked up on it. We came out. We'd had several casualties, about three or four killed. Chinky never did much to us. I went down sniping, but I never saw anything. And after a few times, I thought, well, this is a waste of time. And in all honesty, I don't think I saw a single Chinaman while I was on Nha Chon. I might have thought I did at one or two. But the companies, they would send out raids. We were trying to take prisoners, and we were determined to do it. And we would raid, and I much admired our young officers who went there. They were second to none, and a really tough bunch too, as were some of the men. It just happened that it was time for the Commonwealth Division to go in reserve, something they'd never been. And we were relieved by an American regiment. And I looked out the hoochie, and there's a beaten up old American sergeant. And it was very, very cold that day. The temperature was always below zero, usually about 10 degrees. It went down as far as 30. And I said, "Hey, Yank, do you want a cup of coffee?" And he said, "Oh, I sure do." "So come in here." He says, "Oh, I'm waiting for my officer." I said, "Well, we'll see him if he comes by." So he said, "Oh, this is good." I said, "How would you like a drop of rum in it?" "Rum?" He says, "You guys get rum?" I said, "We do, yeah." He said, "Oh, I love rum." He said, "But we're not allowed it." I said, "Well, I'll put a drop in your coffee." And he thought this was great. His officer arrived, captain. So we gave him a cup of coffee. And I said, "Would you like a drop of rum in it, sir?" And he looked at the sergeant for approval, I think. And he decided that he would. So this was great. I said, "Would you like a bottle of it? Shall I leave you a bottle?" And he said, "Well, if we keep it from the guys, we could do that." I said, "Yeah, okay." And I just put my head under the bed, pulled out a gallon jar of rum. I couldn't believe this. They wanted to pay me for it and all sorts, but I often wonder what happened to that. However, they weren't a very good lot, this, that came over. We weren't very impressed with them. And we went back, and we were in reserve. This was great. Except it was cold, and we were now in tents. And the tents were much colder than the hoochies, the dugouts. You're always a lot warmer underground, and you're a lot cooler, and you're a lot safer too. But the tents, really cold. However, we went on and training, getting our people, mortars trained up. And Captain Bill Blakey left, and out came an international rugby player who'd been my mortar officer before and I knew well, EMP Hardy, Mike Hardy, and we nicknamed him Vital Michael. To give you some idea, he was on the go all the time and never let a thing pass. He was great. The platoon really got bucked up when he came. Bill Blakey was a smashing fellow and a very likeable chap. But he was a bit easygoing. Then we were heard that we were to go back into the line on the Hook. The Hook was a dreaded place. And we did, you know, when we told the guy in there, we thought, "Oh, hell. We're going to know what it's like now." And the reason we were to go, the mortar platoon was going on its own, was to support the Black Watch. The Black Watch was commanded by Colonel Rose, and he said that manpower can't hold it. We need all the firepower we can get. So he got an extra mortar platoon. He already had two platoons of his own, and ours came along. This made a total of 14 mortars, which is a tremendous amount, really, the amount of fire they can put down. We went up there, we're going, dug in, all very nice. And we relieved an American platoon. I think the Black Watch had relieved an American regiment. And this regiment was as good as the other ones were bad. They were absolutely first class. The positions they left us and everything was as good as any British regiment I ever saw. They left a rear link radio man behind to keep in touch in case we needed advice or they needed to be called back or anything like that. And to our surprise, this fella, he was there for about 3 or 4 days. He did nothing but pull his boots up. And he had the shiniest pair of boots I'd ever seen. Something we didn't expect from the Americans. He also thought we were great, mainly because we had cooks and we cooked our own food and we had hot meals, whereas they just lived out of the can. After a while, I was told, go and take over one of the Black Watch platoons. I hadn't been in the OP, the Black Watch were doing that. The Black Watch commander, platoon commander, has been shut up and there's no one to command them. You go. I thought, hell's bells. These Black Watch won't like me. An assassin act will stick me in the porridge pot. So I went up there. And just as I walked into the command post, a fire order came through for the whole platoon. Well, must be a big target. And I thought, I listened to it, there's something wrong with this. The range is very short. He can't fire the whole platoon just in front of his own position. There's not a battalion of Chinese or something. Something wrong with it. So I said to the radio operator, I'd hardly spoken to him. I said, give them stop. And he says, you can't do it, Sergeant. I said, give them stop. And he says, you'll have Major Buchanan on you. I says, never mind, give it, quick. So he gave stop. Means, now, one thing you never do is interfere with a fire order. And this is what I'd done. And Major Buchanan was the Black Watch support company officer, and he was very, very good. He was a hell of a disciplinarian, and if you made one little mistake on your radio procedure, that phone would ring and he'd have you. And of course the phone rang. Why have you given stop? I said, let me check it out, sir. There's something wrong with this order. And I checked with the OP on the telephone, so Chinky couldn't hear. And he was enraged that I'd stopped his fire order. And I said, well, check your bearings, check your range. And a message came, checked, carry on. I thought, hell no, give them stop again. No telephone this time. And I said, this order is not right. For goodness sake, check it again. So he did this and he says, it's perfectly all right. And in the meantime, I got my map out and had a quick look at it. And I said, give me the range to your target. And he did do. I said, give me the range to your OP. And what he'd done is he got the map grid reference of his OP mixed up with his target. And he was about to bring 140 bombs on top of himself. Fortunately, I twigged it. Something was wrong, so nothing happened and he got away with it. However, the Dukes came and they took over the hook. By now, the Chinese were building up for an attack, and every night they would broadcast, "Black Watch, we know you've been relieved by the Jukes. You had a bad time last time, but that's nothing to what you're going to get this time." So everybody's knees started knocking them. We all sort of laughed at it, but underneath we thought, "Oh hell, we don't care for this." I went up to the OP in the Hook, and it was a very eerie place. You sort of sensed there were ghosts around. You could still smell bodies, and the rats were the fattest in Korea, though they didn't lack food from the bodies that were lying out in no man's land. I sat in the OP and I didn't budge from it. I slept there and stayed there. I cleaned up my grenades and emptied my Sten gun magazines, and I had a Bren gun bought up, and I cleaned all the magazines and ammunition. I spent my day by shooting at what do we call them, harassing tasks. We had so many rounds to fire, 50 per each mortar, just to annoy the Chinese. And I had a map with all their positions marked, all their mortar positions, all their gun positions, all their forming up areas. One was the cookhouse. At meal times, he used to get it. At nights, we'd lay on these things and sentries would just go around and pop an odd bomb down just to keep the chinks alive. I also registered all the DF, defensive fire, SOS tasks. And you would do this, all the areas where the enemy could form up to attack. And you would register this, the range, the bearing, the grid bearing that it was on. And you would give it a code name and call that DFS SOS task, or code name Orange, code name Apple. One was code name Betty Grable. And that was a popular one. But it was a feature that had two twin hills. And so they compared this with Betty Grable's body, and that's how it got that name. We were building up for the attack, and the shelling started coming down heavy. We were getting something like 1,000 shells coming in a day on an area about the size of, say, at the most, 4 rugby pitches. Casualties were mounting and being trickling back. Nothing came my way, or very little. And I thought, well, any time, tonight's the night, was the word that went around, tonight's the night, be ready. But they suddenly decided to, the colonel decided that he would take Major Firth's company off, they'd had enough, and put another one who was fresh, ready for the attack. And at the same time, I would be relieved, because I would be promoted to quartermaster sergeant. Now, this I had refused twice, because it wasn't an administrative time. I liked to be where the guns were. And Colonel sent for me. He said, "I'm making you a quartermaster." And